a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson on Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
World leaders, including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have been gathering in London to talk about rebuilding Ukraine. They've already pledged billions of dollars to aid to help rebuild the war-torn country. Part of that, of course, will go to infrastructure. But reconstructing Ukraine can't just include hammering out new buildings. For long-term success, Ukraine has to win a war on two fronts. What are they? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, Ukraine has been on an interesting path in this war. It has been noted that it really is a two-front war. One is, of course, dealing with Russia. The other is less known and beyond the headlines, and that's dealing with its own internal corruption. A new report from the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund and the Brookings Institution outlines how international stakeholders, including the U.S. Congress, the EU, G7, and Ukraine, can rebuild without that corruption and interference. Josh Rudolph is the senior fellow for malign finance at the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund and one of the authors of this new report that I think is so crucial. And Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Boyd. Nice to speak with you.
So as you look at what's going on, and obviously the meetings being held in London, talking about obviously billions of dollars going, you've really done the deep dive in terms of where they really are in Ukraine in terms of overcoming that corruption and things that have been embedded within that country for a really long time. Give us some perspective of the research and what the keys are.
Sure. In terms of where they are and stepping back, they are about halfway through a generational struggle that started on the streets of the Maidan in Kyiv almost a decade ago. A long internal battle to uproot oligarchy and corruption. It's an uphill battle to transform a post-Soviet oligarchy into a modern European state under the rule of law, but they've never looked back. They've done a lot. And so we take stock in that and describe how it's contrary. Their unprecedented success over the past decade is contrary to the disinformation peddled by the Kremlin and its propagandists. That they've had notable success, but there's a lot more to do. When I say obviously halfway through, there's a whole another decade probably here. Corruption is still entrenched across all three branches of their government. They've had setbacks, including recently as well. So more to be done, but they're winning on both fronts of this war.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing. We haven't talked nearly enough about that, what Ukraine was like before Russia invaded, and it was on this journey. And I think it's one of the hardest journeys for a country that's trying to get, you know, as a fledgling democracy and move things forward, that deep-seated corruption built within government institutions, the oligarchy and so on. So give us some of the areas where Ukraine has made some of those important steps forward. And then most important, what do they need to do next to continue that march? Because it is a tough march to root out that kind of corruption deep-seated in a country.
Yeah, they have frankly done more in the past decade than any country has done within just a decade. Mm. If you think back, even back into the last century, the countries that had really strong transitions away from corrupt systems, every, you know, place from South Korea to some of the other Eastern Europeans, like the Baltic countries or some others in the late 90s. They were able to do that over several decades, and they did not have to do it in this context of a neighboring kleptocracy war criminal that's mobilizing billions in its own oligarchy and its intelligence services, and of course now its military, to try to do everything possible to stop that transition. So it's been more challenging, but despite that, they have built the, and actually not even despite it, but because it's so difficult there, they have had to go further than any other reform movement in the degree of transparency that they've built into their political economic system. The degree of independence in this whole suite of specialized anti-corruption agencies, they've restructured entire sectors of the economy. They've decentralized their governance, and that's just the policy.
Yeah.
On the political side, voters come back again and again and renew this mandate for anti-corruption. And when implementation flags, civil society and foreign partners step in and pressure the government to make good on that mandate. So it's a constant struggle. They've done a lot, but what I would say, including to your question about what more is to be done, is that they have this system in place that is working well. Even during the war, you see continued investigation and prosecution of corrupt actors like you have in every country. The difference there is that there is actually some accountability for it. These are still relatively new agencies, and they need continued cultivation, investment, additional resources and authorities and leadership. So there's a lot to continue to strengthen that system that's working.
Yeah, and I think that whole component of the integrity, the transparency, the security that builds and fosters that trust. I actually think, and just going through your report, which is so insightful, I think that's one of the things that Vladimir Putin fears the most, is that a Ukraine that is transparent, that does have integrity and security and the confidence of the people, that's the greatest threat, I think, to Vladimir Putin and what he's doing. I also really appreciated in this paper that you've put forward that you went to that next step of what needs to continue to go. And I just want to hit on a couple of these just really quickly, including that need for to invest more in investigative journalism, making sure that they're, you know, getting the right kind of financing in terms of how those different sectors of the economy get rolling. Give us some of those pieces in terms of context and why they're so critical for Ukraine moving forward.
Wow, boy, that recommendation is on page 37. I appreciate that you've gotten through the report. That's right. They need. I mean, there is a good, very strong cohort of investigative journalists who've been doing their job, including during the war, highlighting issues and going public and having investigations that have pressured the government. And then Zelensky has acted on those, you know, including as recently as January, February, when there were a number of senior officials who, including some who were close to Zelensky himself, who he fired because they were subject of investigative journalism, seeing that they're parading around in these Porsches and BMWs and whatnot. But they need more. They are going to need a lot more when we're going to be talking about hundreds of billions of dollars eventually coming into the country to rebuild at least hundreds of projects around the country. And you're going to need scrutiny on all of those. They're working on that. The Ukrainians, they're developing transparency systems, but you're also the international donor community needs to put more money into investigative journalism to make sure they have eyes on it too.
Yeah, it's so important. And this is such a critical deep dive, because it's so easy to get caught in the headlines. And of course, a lot of praise for Ukraine and for President Zelensky. All of those things are true. And at the same time, if we don't get this next level thing going, it'll be short lived, because it will go back to the kind of oligarchy and corruption that was there previously. And I think this is an important piece I think this information is vital. I love the recommendations you have for each of the major players there. And I actually think there's a lot of things that you all have outlined in this paper that could also be applied right here at home to make sure we ensure our own transparency and trust in democracy moving forward. Josh Rudolph is the Senior Fellow for Malign Finance at the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. And Josh, I want to have you back to continue this conversation because it is a behind and beyond the headlines that I think is real crucial, not just for Ukraine, but for a lot of other places in the world as well.
That's right. We can learn from the Ukrainians and some of the aggressive ways that they're approaching it. Thanks. Nice talking to you, Boyd.
All right. Again, that's Josh Rudolph from the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. And this is important because it's not enough to just prop up these little fledgling democracies. You have to make sure you have systems in place that allow entrepreneurs to thrive, civil society to grow and flourish. And I think this report that they have put out in the context of these meetings happening in London today that are absolutely vital to the future of Ukraine, rooting out the rest of that corruption that was part of the oligarchy from before, but also some very important lessons for us right here at home.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.